This is Audible.
Macmillan Audio presents Killing the Mob by Bill O'Reilly and Martin Dugard. Narrated for you by Robert Petkoff. This book is dedicated to my late father and mother, who always obeyed the law and passed that dedication on to their children. Prologue. March 3, 1934, Lake County Jail, Crown Point, Indiana, 9:15 a.m. The man with 4 months to live is about to bust out of jail. This is a cold and rainy Saturday morning. 30-year-old John Dillinger, America's most famous bank robber, has finished his meager prison breakfast and now mills around with 14 other inmates in a jailhouse corridor. He enjoys his only exercise of the day, but has much more on his mind. Dillinger is a charming celebrity inmate, standing 5'7", with a crooked smile, trim athletic build, and thinning brown hair. He is well known as a ladies' man. A career criminal from Indianapolis whose only legitimate job was a short stint in the U.S. Navy, Dillinger has spent his adult life in and out of prisons. Nevertheless, he has become famous. Such is Dillinger's notoriety that the prosecuting attorney and sheriff in his current court case both demanded to have a picture taken with their arms around his shoulders. It has been 5 weeks since authorities in Tucson, Arizona arrested Dillinger and his gang. The four gangsters had committed 8 bank robberies throughout the Midwest in the previous year and had gone farther west to escape the law. Additionally, state police arsenals were brazenly raided to steal machine guns, pistols, and ammunition. The Dillinger Gang, as they are known, plans heists with great sophistication, utilizing detailed getaway maps and high-horsepower vehicles to outrun law enforcement. They also brandish Thompson submachine guns. Each man plays a specific role in the robberies, whether as a driver, lookout, or vault man. But it is the self-assured Dillinger who strides into a bank, opens a leather case containing his Thompson, and yells, "This is a stick-up!" to the tellers and bank customers. Dillinger makes no attempt to hide his handsome face, and as the numbers of robberies mount between June 21, 1933, and January 15, 1934, his legend grows. It is bad luck that gets Dillinger and his band captured in Tucson. 2 of the men are staying at the Hotel Congress when a broken furnace leads to a fire, forcing an evacuation of all rooms. Rather than let their belongings burn, gang members Russell Clark and Charles Mackley bribe firefighters to climb back up the ladders to retrieve their luggage. Tucson is a small town with a population of just over 30,000. The suspicious behavior of these strangers catches the attention of firefighter William Benedict, who identifies Mackley and Clark from a photo he remembers in True Detective magazine. Benedict then notifies the Tucson police, and over the course of the next 4 days, the gang is carefully tracked and eventually captured. John Dillinger is the last man arrested. He is carrying $7,000 in cash, some of which can be traced to a recent robbery in East Chicago, Indiana. There, police officer William Patrick O'Malley was killed in cold blood, shot dead with 8 bullets to the chest by Dillinger himself. So when it comes time for Tucson prosecutors to extradite the gang to the scenes of their many crimes, Mackley, Clark, and Pete Pierpont are first flown in handcuffs to Ohio, there to stand trial for a deputy murdered while the three were breaking John Dillinger out of a small-town jail in October 1933. Footnote. All 3 men will be convicted. Russell Clark receives a life sentence. Charles Mackley and Pete Pierpont will be sentenced to death. However, on September 22, 1934, all 3 will attempt to escape from the Ohio State Prison in Columbus. Clark has a change of heart and returns to his cell. Mackley is shot dead. Pierpont is captured alive. Still wounded from his failed prison break, the 32-year-old Pierpont must be carried to the electric chair, where he is executed on October 17, 1934. End footnote. But Dillinger does not go to Ohio. He is extradited here to Crown Point, located 15 miles south of Lake Michigan, where he will be tried for the killing of Officer O'Malley. The electric chair looms if he is convicted. But John Dillinger has no intention of standing trial. The second floor of the Lake County Jail is considered escape-proof. Since his arrival in early February, Dillinger spends most days alone in his barred cell with its simple bed and small bucket for a toilet. On those occasions when Dillinger's jailers allow him to step outside, it is either to eat, exercise, or empty slop jars of human waste from his cell and those of other prisoners. The wardens and deputies take great pride in making the legendary John Dillinger perform this grim duty, a way of reminding the famous captive that he is now powerless. Dillinger plays along, pretending to be unbothered. "I played the good fellow with all the guards at the jail," Dillinger will later recall. "I patted them on the back and told them what fine fellows they were. I volunteered for all the distasteful jobs that had to be done." In this way, Dillinger convinces the guards that he is no longer a threat. His daily habit of whittling a piece of wood has not drawn suspicion. Instead, the guards have made this another point of mockery, calling him John the Whittler. But on this Saturday morning, as 64-year-old jailhouse trustee Sam Cahoon slips into the exercise area carrying soap for the showers, the end result of Dillinger's whittling becomes quite obvious. The block of wood has been carved into the shape of a small pistol. Now, before Cahoon can close the prison door behind him, Dillinger presses the fake weapon hard into the trustee's torso. "I'll blow you apart," the bank robber snarls, any vestige of sweet disposition now vanished. Using Cahoon as a shield, Dillinger works his way through the jail, not only convincing his guards that he possesses a gun, but ordering them to lock themselves inside cells. Finally, Dillinger arrives at the warden's office, where one of the guards sleeps soundly in a desk chair. Gliding quietly across the room, Dillinger removes an automatic weapon from a gun rack and presses the barrel into the back of the guard's head. "This is Dillinger," says the bank robber. "If you move a muscle, I'll blow your head off your shoulders." Dillinger then leaves the jailhouse a free man, stealing the sheriff's personal vehicle to make his getaway. The jail is affixed to the sheriff's house, so the theft is an easy one. There is no two-way radio in the car or in any other law enforcement vehicle, so the Crown Point sheriff has no way of alerting police officers on the interstate that a wanted criminal is heading their way. Thus, John Dillinger drives at a furious pace toward Chicago. Roughly 10 miles after fleeing the red brick building housing the Lake County Jail, Dillinger drives the stolen vehicle across the Indiana-Illinois state line. In so doing, he violates the National Motor Vehicle Theft Act. To this point in his bank robbing career, Dillinger had only broken state and local laws. But by committing an offense against what is also known as the Dyer Act, John Dillinger has violated a federal law for the first time. Unbeknownst to him, a special unit from the Department of Justice will now take control of the hunt for John Dillinger. It was first known as the Bureau of Investigation, BOI for short, and then Division of Investigation, or DOI. Its leader is a 39-year-old lawyer named J. Edgar Hoover. And Hoover will stop at nothing to catch his man, no matter how long it takes. Part 1. The Gunners. Chapter 1. May 26, 1934, Aspen Hill Memorial Park, Silver Spring, Maryland, morning. violence is plaguing America. Throughout 1933 and the first half of 1934, dozens of vicious and heavily armed gangsters are creating carnage in rural parts of the United States. It is the middle of the Great Depression. The average national individual income has been cut in half. The nationwide unemployment rate is 21.7%. The homicide tally is the highest of the century due to rampant poverty and the clash of immigrant and traditional cultures as America becomes increasingly urban. In addition, half of all home mortgages are delinquent, and more than 1,000 home loans are foreclosed every day. As more and more American families are evicted, the banks are viewed as predatory villains, more intent on making a dollar than helping poor people survive. So it is no surprise that some criminals in the United States are actually becoming popular public figures, especially the handful of men and women who rob banks for a living. The Division of Investigation calls these people public enemies. But to many, they are Robin Hoods, exacting revenge on bankers and fat cats from Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon. On this warm Saturday morning, the man who has just been handed the enormous responsibility of stopping the Robin Hoods is momentarily unconcerned about fighting crime. John Edgar Hoover is in a state of deep mourning as he watches his beloved dog lowered into a grave in this Washington suburb. Hoover has lived in the District of Columbia his whole life. He began his career of public service at 18. A high school class valedictorian who landed work as a clerk at the Library of Congress while attending college and then law school. Hoover's employment ended when he passed the bar in 1917. He took a job with the Justice Department the very next morning. Within 2 years, the young lawyer's work ethic saw him promoted rapidly. By 1924, at the behest of President Calvin Coolidge, 29-year-old J. Edgar Hoover was placed in charge of a corrupt federal agency known as the Bureau of Investigation. Footnote. Hoover was actually appointed by Coolidge's Attorney General, Harlan Fisk Stone. Hoover was assistant director of the Bureau at the time. Director William Burns was accused of involvement in the Teapot Dome scandal, leading to his resignation and Hoover's appointment as director. Burns's leadership was symptomatic of the Bureau's pre-Hoover corruption, a period that included collusion with bootleggers, selling protection, selling sensitive Bureau files, and swapping employment in the agency for political favors. End footnote. The promotion appears to be a career dead end for the hard-charging young lawyer with the receding hairline, permanent scowl, and the habit of talking too fast in order to hide a stutter. Founded in 1908, the Bureau of Investigation is America's first national law enforcement agency. However, there is widespread fear in Congress that the BOI might become a secret police, spying upon the people, such as has prevailed in Russia. So Congress has intentionally limited the BOI's power. The original 34 agents are forbidden to carry a weapon, and even prevented from making arrests. When it comes time to take a suspect into custody, the agents have a choice: either call in U.S. Marshals or the local police. Hoover devotes himself to his new job, eschewing any semblance of a personal life in favor of complete commitment to law enforcement. Immediately, the new director cleans house, firing any agent accused of taking bribes. He sets up a rigorous training program to ensure that his agents are mentally and physically fit. Also, his investigators are expected to be of high moral character, with training in accounting or law. There is no such thing as paid overtime. Hoover raises the BOI's profile by establishing the first nationwide database for fingerprints. And yet, the BOI is powerless to prosecute the bank robberies and the random murders plaguing America during the Great Depression. State and local police have complete authority in such cases, despite the frustrating reality that these agencies do not communicate with one another, nor can they chase criminals across state lines. John Dillinger has made an art of escaping this way. There is no question that J. Edgar Hoover is a strange man. He has few friends and lives at home with his 75-year-old mother, Anna Marie. The director's most trusted confidant is his Airedale terrier, Spee DeBozo. It is Spee who fetches the paper each morning and eats the soft-boiled egg that Hoover gives him for breakfast. J. Edgar loves Spee so much that he not only keeps the animal's framed photo on his office desk, but also hangs a painting of the Airedale on a wall at home. Hoover may be a tough boss with his agents, but he never disciplines his dog. Spee DeBozo passes away on May 24th at the age of 11, and now his shroud-covered body is being lowered into the grave at this pet cemetery. "This is one of the saddest days of my life," the grief-stricken Hoover explains to a groundskeeper. His display of emotion is unnerving to the three DOI agents who have been asked to accompany him to the burial, for Hoover is normally a closed vault of privacy. At the same time, the director is actually becoming one of the most powerful men in the country. On May 18th, Congress recognizes that state and local law enforcement agencies are powerless to stop the bank robbing epidemic. This is a reaction to the 1933 Kansas City massacre, where criminals, led by a robber known as Pretty Boy Floyd, shot and killed four federal agents in cold blood. Thus, the Crime Control Acts of 1934 were passed. Now, if a person kills or assaults a federal officer, transports kidnapped persons, or robs a bank, they are subject to federal law. They will be charged with federal crimes. State troopers and local sheriffs will no longer have jurisdiction in these matters. That power now goes to the newly renamed Division of Investigation. Just as important, Congress is about to pass another important piece of legislation allowing DOI agents to bear arms and make arrests. As Spee DeBozo's burial comes to an end, J. Edgar Hoover promises himself that he will soon buy another dog. Footnote: J. Edgar Hoover would have 8 more dogs after Spee DeBozo, many of which were interred in the same plot. The tombstone and gravesite can still be found at the Aspen Hill Memorial Park. End footnote. The time for mourning quickly passes. The time for catching violent bank robbers is about to begin. And there will be blood. Chapter 2. May 23, 1934, Bienville Parish, Louisiana, 9:15 a.m. 23-year-old Bonnie Parker sits in the passenger seat of a stolen Ford V8. On her lap rests a bacon, lettuce, and tomato sandwich on white bread wrapped in a napkin. Thick forest and bushes line the dusty country road on both sides. Bonnie's lover, Clyde Champion Barrow, is at the wheel, pushing 65 miles per hour because the couple is late for a rendezvous. Clyde, 25, has already finished his fried bologna sandwich purchased during the couple's recent stop at Ma Canfield's Cafe in the nearby Louisiana town of Gibbsland. Clyde loves the high-powered V8 so much, he wrote a letter to automotive manufacturer Henry Ford praising its speed and freedom. The bank robber wears wire-rimmed sunglasses and a blue shirt and suit with a matching hat, but drives in his stocking feet. Long ago, the convicted criminal asked a fellow inmate to cut off 2 of his toes with an axe to escape hard labor in prison. As a result, Clyde walks with a limp, and driving while wearing shoes is extremely uncomfortable. Ironically, prison officials had already decided to parole young Clyde before the axe dropped. He limped out of prison a free man just 6 days after the mutilation. Bonnie's hat, her trademark Tam, has been tossed into the back seat. The poetry-writing criminal wears a wedding ring, though she left her unfaithful husband years before falling for Clyde. She is a petite 4 feet 11 inches tall, chain-smokes Camel cigarettes, and has her ex-husband's name still tattooed inside her right thigh. A long red dress reveals Bonnie's hourglass figure, but hides her legs because they were badly burned by battery acid after crashing during a high-speed car chase 1 year ago. As a result, Bonnie Parker also walks with a limp, just like Clyde. Sometimes her pain is so bad that she cannot walk at all, and he must carry her. Yet Bonnie wears high heels rather than flat soles, even though they will make it more difficult for her to run from the law should the need arise. Widely known as Bonnie and Clyde, the young couple has robbed banks since beginning their crime spree in February 1932. But as they moved through Missouri, Louisiana, Texas, New Mexico, and even north to Minnesota, taking advantage of poor communications between state and local authorities to stay ahead of the law, bank robbery is just one of the crimes they commit. They have stolen cars and robbed stores and gas stations at gunpoint for as little as $5. On the violent side, they have kidnapped people and shot dead at least 13 men and women. All told, the couple has committed more than 100 felonies in 2 years. Bonnie and Clyde first met in January 1930. She, a recently unemployed waitress, and he, a poor laborer from the slums of Dallas. Other than petty theft, Clyde Barrow had no criminal record at the time. But just months later, he is arrested for burglary and sent to the Eastham Prison Farm, where, after being routinely sexually assaulted, he commits his first murder. Clyde kills another prisoner with a lead pipe to avenge his prison rapes. Thus, the mild-mannered Barrow is forever changed by Eastham Prison. From a schoolboy to a rattlesnake, in the words of one fellow inmate. Despite his 2 years behind bars, Bonnie has waited for him. Upon release, and fueled by a hatred for the law, the couple begins committing crimes throughout the Midwest. Theirs is a simple life of robbing for money and food whenever they need it, and killing the hated police when they can. Other criminals join them as part of a small gang. But while these men come and go, the partnership of Bonnie and Clyde remains steady. The couple were essentially small-time Southern hoods, forever in the shadow of bigger criminal names like John Dillinger and his cronies Babyface Nelson and Pretty Boy Floyd. But just 1 year ago, April 13, 1933, police surprised Bonnie and Clyde at a hideout in Joplin, Missouri. The aftermath was gruesome, with two police officers shot dead. The couple escaped by driving more than 600 miles through the night into the heart of Texas. But in the ruins of the Missouri hideout, police discover a roll of undeveloped film. Wishing to familiarize the public with descriptions of Bonnie and Clyde, Joplin police develop the film and give the pictures to the Joplin Globe newspaper, which wires the photos nationwide. The result is instant celebrity. Images of Bonnie poking a grinning Clyde with a sawed-off shotgun, and Bonnie posing alone with a cigar in her mouth and pistol in her hand, make the two as famous as movie stars. Not only does the American public clamor for more information about Bonnie and Clyde, but their exploits soon became fodder for movie newsreels as an excited nation cheers for them to outfox law enforcement. The criminal couple could not be happier. Both have nursed dreams of fame, Bonnie through her writing and quiet dreams of being a famous actress, and Clyde as a musician who plays the saxophone. On May 21, 1934, just 3 days after Congress passes the new crime legislation to expand federal law enforcement, J. Edgar Hoover decides to go to war with Bonnie and Clyde. His first move? An 8-inch by 8-inch wanted poster bearing their images and listing their crimes is circulated nationwide. Unlike the Joplin photos, There is nothing glamorous about these images. Yet, that only enhances the legend of Bonnie and Clyde. However, Bonnie Parker somehow knows the truth of what is to come, writing flowery verse predicting that she and Clyde will die horribly. Footnote. The verse goes this way. Someday they'll go down together, and they'll bury them side by side. To a few it will be grief, to the law a relief, but it's death for Bonnie and Clyde. End footnote. As they drive down the rural Louisiana road, Bonnie and Clyde are 15 minutes late for a meeting with a member of their gang on this muggy Wednesday morning. The stop for Bonnie's BLT to go at Ma Canfield's cafe has put them behind schedule. All seems well. Rounding a bend in the road, a flatbed truck belonging to Ivy Methvin, father of the convicted criminal they are due to meet, can be seen on the shoulder. Methvin kneels by the jacked-up vehicle, changing a tire. A logging truck approaches from the other direction. Clyde shifts into first gear. His window is already rolled down. Bonnie places the sandwich, still in its napkin, on her lap. In the back seat, under a blanket, are a pile of guns, a suitcase full of cash, and Clyde's personal saxophone. Suddenly, Ivy Methvin rolls under his truck. The hidden posse is armed and dangerous. Frank Hamer of the Texas Rangers has been tracking Bonnie and Clyde for 4 months. He has followed the pair to Bienville Parish with three other Texas lawmen. J. Edgar Hoover and his agents are not taking part in the posse, but have provided crucial information on the couple's whereabouts. The Division of Investigation has pinpointed this region of Louisiana as a regular hiding place for Bonnie and Clyde. In order to obtain the necessary jurisdiction to capture the criminals, the Texas Ranger has enlisted the aid of local Sheriff Jordan Henderson and his young deputy, Prentice Oakley. Together, the lawmen set a trap, believing the criminals will eventually go to the home of gang member Henry Methvin. Footnote. Ivan Methvin is 49 when he volunteers to work as a decoy in the hunt for Bonnie and Clyde. Despite Ivan's efforts to help his son, Henry Methvin later went to prison for his role in the murder of an Oklahoma policeman. Ivan, who died in 1949, was predeceased by his son, who was crushed while drunkenly trying to crawl under a moving train. End footnote. Ranger Hamer has promised Henry's father that his son will not receive the death penalty for his crimes in exchange for betraying Bonnie and Clyde. Thus, Ivy Methvin's flatbed pickup, specially designed for hauling pulpwood, is now strategically positioned to block the road on which the criminals are driving. After nearly 30 hours of hiding, the posse is irritated and exhausted from waiting in the woods as thick clouds of mosquitoes swarm them. The day is already sweltering. Strung out in the forest, each man clutches his favorite weapon. Loaded and cocked backup guns are scattered on the pine straw. The collection of rifles, pistols, and automatics is formidable, the trademark of men quite comfortable in the art of killing. Frank Hamer personally believes that a simple .45 caliber round to the gut is the best way to immobilize a suspect. Just to be sure, the relentless lawman is also armed with a Remington Model 11 shotgun and Colt Monitor machine rifle, a powerful World War I relic capable of killing a man from a mile away. As the posse shifts restlessly, they see in the distance a Ford V8 racing down the road at top speed. The men cock their weapons. The plan is simple. When Clyde Barrow slows down to approach the disabled truck, posse member Ted Hinton will confirm if the individuals in the vehicle are indeed Bonnie and Clyde. Hinton is from Dallas and knows Bonnie from her waitressing days. Once visual recognition is achieved, Hamer will step forward, Colt Monitor rifle leveled, and demand their surrender. Frank Hamer is 6'2" and solidly built, a thick-set man with a gravitas and assumed legal authority expected from a Texas Ranger. Hamer is renowned for his marksmanship and even instructs new Rangers on the art of shooting. He will have no trouble opening fire should Bonnie and Clyde refuse to step out of the car and raise their hands in the air. The only question in the mind of Frank Hamer is whether or not he can shoot a woman. As the Ford V8 draws closer and Ivy Methvin assumes his position as a decoy on the ground, Hamer steels himself for the confrontation. His current location is a hillside overlooking the road. There is every chance he will be shot if Bonnie or Clyde sees him making his way onto the road. The Ford V8 is flying down the road in a cloud of dust. As hoped, Hamer and the posse hear the telltale sound of downshifting and watch as the car slows to a stop alongside Methvin's truck. Hamer looks at Ted Hinton, just to make sure the young couple in the car are Bonnie and Clyde. Suddenly, without being given permission, Deputy Oakley opens fire with a Remington Model 8 borrowed from a local dentist. He stands 50 feet to the right of Hamer. Oakley has a clear shot at Clyde through the open window, but several of his bullets miss, hitting the doorframe. However, one 2-inch casing passes neatly through the left side of Clyde Barrow's skull, blowing open a gaping wound as it kills him. Bonnie Parker, sandwich still on her lap, knows she is about to die as well. She screams in terror, a feral howl so mournful that the lawmen will remember it the rest of their lives. The scream ends as the posse opens fire. The brutal shooting lasts 16 seconds. Bonnie and Clyde die immediately, but the firing does not stop until the frame and windows of the Ford are riddled with 167 bullets. When it is done, as the smell of gunpowder carries through the Louisiana countryside, Frank Hamer steps onto the road clutching his Colt automatic. As leader of this posse, it is his obligation to make sure the job is complete. The Ranger loosens a burst into the rear window, just to be sure. Clyde is not visible, so Hamer's shots are focused on Bonnie, whose head still can be seen inside the car. Any doubts that he can shoot a woman have been answered. The Texas Ranger then walks to the front of the Ford and takes direct aim at Bonnie from point-blank range. The legendary criminal is already dead, her head riddled with bullets as blood pours from wounds across her torso. Frank Hamer squeezes the trigger anyway. The Colt kicks backward as he fires a final burst into the dead woman. Just to be sure. 2,000 miles away, J. Edgar Hoover is unaware that the federal fugitives he has been chasing have been slaughtered. They will not be the last. Chapter 3. May 28, 1934, Chicago, Illinois, 7:30 p.m. John Dillinger is almost dead. As anesthesiologist Harold Cassidy removes the towel soaked in ether from the killer's face, he is appalled to see that the unconscious gangster is turning blue. Dillinger has swallowed his tongue and cannot breathe, all because he is being chased. The Division of Investigation has been tracking the bank robber ever since his Indiana jailbreak 2 months ago. Every day, J. Edgar Hoover's G-men come closer to capturing Dillinger and sending him to the electric chair. But Cassidy's incompetence might deny the feds their execution. John Dillinger knows his end may be near, so he is desperately trying to change his appearance. That has led to disaster. Working frantically, Surgeon Wilhelm Loser wedges a pair of forceps into the criminal's mouth. Using both hands for leverage, he clamps the instrument around the tongue in an effort to pull it forward and open the airway. As Cassidy looks on helplessly, the ether towel still clutched in his hands, Loser extricates the tongue. A still blacked-out John Dillinger vomits all over himself and the small bed on which he rests. Dr. Loser is a German-born immigrant who did his medical training at the University of Kansas and Northwestern. He recently lost his license to practice medicine after a narcotics conviction that sent him to Leavenworth Penitentiary. Footnote. In 1931, Loser was convicted under a 1914 federal statute known as the Harrison Narcotics Tax Act, which prohibited the selling of opiates and products of the coca plant. End footnote. When killers on the lam like John Dillinger are in need of medical care, law-abiding physicians will usually not cooperate. But Dr. Loser, who practices his trade in secret, is happy to accept $5,000 for the procedure he is about to perform, all the while knowing that his life is in danger from Dillinger's gang should any harm befall the boss. There is no operating theater. Instead, Loser performs his work in the small bedroom of a cottage belonging to a 66-year-old petty criminal and former prize fighter named Jimmy Probasco, who makes $35 a day, allowing fugitives to hide in his Chicago home. Both Loser and Probasco will soon pay dearly for their actions, with the doctor spending more time in prison and Probasco dangled outside the window of a Chicago high-rise by federal agents. He will then plunge 19 stories to his death, which the Division of Investigation will claim to be a suicide. But that is all to come. As Dillinger vomits once more, Loser assures himself that his patient is capable of enduring the operation. Satisfied that this is the case, Loser puts down his forceps and picks up a scalpel. Then, slowly and patiently, Dr. Wilhelm Loser begins cutting away at John Dillinger's face, beginning the plastic surgery intended to make the wanted criminal completely unrecognizable to J. Edgar Hoover and his agents. Footnote. The term plastic surgery is taken from the Greek word plastika, which means to sculpt flesh. It was first applied to the alteration of physical appearance in the medical vernacular in 1839, 70 years before petroleum-based materials were engineered into a new product that was given the name plastic. End footnote. Dillinger moved into Jimmy Probasco's cottage just last night. There was no advance notice. The arrangements were made through mutual friends. He simply walked through the front door carrying a machine gun, two pistols, a bulletproof vest, and several hundred rounds of ammunition, and made himself at home. Dillinger is friendly, if reserved. This is unusual for the bank robber. John Dillinger is a gregarious man. He likes to attend baseball games, go to the movies, and drink in nightclubs. People are drawn to his upbeat personality, not knowing they are talking to a cold-blooded killer. The idea of laying low and not going out in public feels claustrophobic, and Dillinger cannot wait until his recovery from plastic surgery is complete so that he can once again walk the streets of Chicago. But the killer is troubled. Twice in the last 2 months, the DOI manhunt has come within moments of capturing him alive. The first time came in Minneapolis, where Dillinger fled after the Indiana jailbreak in early March. Working with another famous bank robber, Lester Gillis, known as Babyface Nelson, Dillinger and his cohort stole $49,500 from the Security National Bank in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The robbery came just 3 days after Dillinger escaped prison in Indiana. 3 days after that, on March 13th, Dillinger and Nelson stole another $52,344 from the First National Bank of Mason City, Iowa. Footnote. The equivalent of $947,708 and $1,002,235, respectively, in modern currency. End footnote. The pair then split up, with Nelson driving west to Reno, Nevada, while Dillinger rented Unit 303 at the Lincoln Court Apartments in Minneapolis with girlfriend Evelyn Billy Frechette. John Dillinger is normally fond of showing off the 27-year-old half-French, half-Indian Frechette. But the gangster was slightly wounded in the Mason City heist, so the two remain in their apartment most of the time. Their brand-new Hudson sedan is parked outside. But when the pair go out, they leave only through the back door. Noting this behavior, landlord Daisy Coffey grows suspicious, especially after they refuse to allow a handyman inside to fix a bathroom fixture. For reasons known only to the nosy Coffey, her first instinct is not to confront the couple, but to pay a visit to the Division of Investigations St. Paul Field Office, where she files a report. At 10:15 the next morning, agents knock on the door of Unit 303. It is Frechette who answers, telling the agents she needs a few moments to get dressed before closing the door. This event takes place 2 months before DOI agents are legally allowed to carry weapons or make arrests. But, as citizens of the United States, Hoover's men are entitled to the same freedoms of the Second Amendment as all other Americans, and thus use this loophole to bear arms. So it is that DOI agent Rufus Coulter stands outside Unit 303 carrying a loaded revolver. St. Paul Police Detective Henry Cummings is on hand to make any arrests. He is also armed. But the officer's pistols are no match for John Dillinger's Thompson submachine gun. Seeing no other way to escape, Dillinger fires through the door, scattering the agents. He and Frechette race down the stairs to their Hudson, then drive off, though not before Detective Cummings fires 5 shots, one of which hits Dillinger in the left calf. Making use of the same illicit underground medical network he would utilize for his plastic surgery in Chicago, Dillinger has his wound treated by a Minneapolis physician who hides the criminal and his girlfriend for 5 days. But J. Edgar Hoover's agents are relentless. Even after Dillinger and Billy Frechette flee to Indiana in the early days of April, the DOI has compiled a list of their potential hiding places and is thus anticipating their movements. By April 9th, the couple are in Chicago, where agents arrest Frechette in a bar on State Street. She had entered the establishment to see if it was safe. Dillinger, who had a hunch authorities were near, waits outside and can only watch from a distance as his girlfriend is taken into custody. Despondent over losing his companion, but knowing he must flee, Dillinger drives north the length of Wisconsin to a remote vacation camp. Babyface Nelson, recently returned from Reno, joins him. There, at an idyllic lodge known as Little Bohemia, John Dillinger will meet the man who will kill him. Agent Melvin Horace Purvis II is small in stature, standing just 5 feet 4 inches. But he is known to be vicious, questioning suspects with such intensity that many claim their broken bones and bruises are a result of his interrogation. The 30-year-old South Carolina native runs the DOI's Chicago Bureau, but has recently alienated his boss, J. Edgar Hoover, who believes Purvis is not doing enough to capture John Dillinger. So it is with great delight that Purvis receives a tip placing Dillinger and several members of his gang at a remote location in upstate Wisconsin. With a reward of $10,000 for Dillinger's capture, it was only a matter of time before such a break came Purvis's way. The agent triumphantly phones Director Hoover to tell him that Dillinger will soon be surrounded. Then, mindful of Hoover's wrath, Agent Purvis immediately takes extreme measures to make sure Dillinger does not get away. Little Bohemia is 8 hours north of Chicago, actually longer now that winter is lingering and the roads of northern Wisconsin are still covered in ice and snow. Instead of driving, Purvis further risks the anger of the tight-fisted Hoover by chartering 2 airplanes to fly agents from Chicago and St. Paul, Minnesota, into the town of Rhinelander. It is Sunday afternoon, April 22nd. Little Bohemia is a vacation lodge consisting of a two-story main log building with 8 guest rooms and a number of adjacent cabins. The sign out on the main highway touts Little Bohemia as a place to dine, dance, and swim, and local residents often visit to take advantage of the restaurant in the main lodge, which offers a $1 dinner special on Sunday night. So the resort is packed as the agents arrive by car from the airport, armed with machine guns and wearing bulletproof vests. In addition, some men carry tear gas to immobilize the gangsters. As the agents turn off Highway 51 into the lodge's gravel driveway, Purvis orders 2 vehicles to block the drive, preventing Dillinger and his gang from escaping. A strict order of silence is enforced as agents fan out into the woods, stepping lightly through the snow-covered forest surrounding the main lodge. Dogs chained outside the main building begin barking at their scent. Dillinger is known to be in the company of perhaps a dozen gang members, including Babyface Nelson and his wife. The agents are relieved that there is no one outside to inquire about the barking. In fact, John Dillinger will later remember hearing the yapping dogs as he played cards, but thought nothing of it. Which is strange. The criminal underworld in which John Dillinger thrives is founded upon suspicion and paying attention. Using the hotel's telephone, for instance, is a grave risk because there is no privacy on the party lines that dominate rural American telephone systems. Better to locate a public payphone when coordinating a rendezvous with gang members. Paying loyal intermediaries or family members to set up a meeting and arrange a quiet place to settle down for a few days is another tactic Dillinger often uses. There is also the strategy of leaving messages for other known criminals at safe houses, common hideouts used by gangs and wanted men. In this way, the underworld has its own informal post office. This involves trusting others with life and freedom. Even the choice of Little Bohemia as a hideout was made through criminal connections. 46-year-old owner Emil Wanatka was once closely connected with the Chicago underworld. But Dillinger is feared, and he knows it. So betrayal is not a factor. Nevertheless, the bank robber is usually very alert to potential danger. Not tonight. As federal agents slowly cinch the noose tighter around the Little Bohemia Lodge, Dillinger feels as if he is completely safe. Northern Wisconsin is hundreds of miles from a major city. The thought of federal agents traveling across icy, snow-covered roads to ambush him seems an impossibility. But the killer is wrong. In fact, Emil Wanatka has furtively alerted federal agents about the bank robber's location. Wanatka wants the $10,000 reward. Meanwhile, Dillinger ignores the barking dogs and deals another hand of cards. The Wisconsin night is completely dark. It is almost 8 p.m. at Little Bohemia. Things now go horribly wrong. 3 local men have just finished dinner and are walking together to their car. Northern Wisconsin is a hunter's paradise, and each man carries a rifle, arousing the suspicion of the hidden agents. As the men step into the car, driver John Hoffman blasts the radio loudly as he begins to drive away. Therefore, Hoffman and his friends John Morris and Eugene Boineau do not hear the agents shouting for them to stop the car. The windshield is fogged from the cold, so they do not see the officers now leveling automatic weapons at their vehicle. An oblivious John Hoffman continues barreling toward the restaurant exit. Melvin Purvis will later defend his agents, stating that they were aiming for the vehicle's tires. But the hard truth is that the DOI men were shooting to kill, machine gunning the car's body and windows. Miraculously, only Boineau dies. The other 2 men, not knowing who is shooting at them, are wounded, but manage to run into the woods. But the death of Eugene Boineau is the least of Purvis's worries. Machine gun fire can be heard as far as a mile away. Instantly, John Dillinger knows those gunshots are not for hunting. Dillinger and the other members of his gang race to their rooms to get their automatic weapons. In the chaos, the Dillinger group flees into the woods, eluding Purvis and his agents. Babyface Nelson shoots and kills a DOI agent before making his own escape. The dark and dense forest makes it impossible for the federal men to pursue because of the potential hostile fire. Hoover, a man addicted to adulation, had foolishly alerted certain media that Dillinger's demise was at hand. In an attempt to elevate his personal profile, the director has released a personal statement to the press, letting them know that he is completely in charge of the manhunt and deserves all credit for Dillinger's arrest. 4 hours later in Washington, a furious and embarrassed J. Edgar Hoover announces to the media that once again, John Dillinger has eluded capture. 1 month later, in Jimmy Probasco's house at 2509 Crawford Avenue on the north side of Chicago, John Dillinger is covered in blood and vomit as Dr. Wilhelm Loser completes the plastic surgery. Gone are three prominent moles above the gangster's eye, as well as the dimple in his chin, which has been filled with tissue removed from his cheek. Loser has tightened the muscles of Dillinger's face, giving him a mild lift. The gangster's nose has been slit open, then completely reconstructed. Loser will soon pour lye on Dillinger's fingertips to burn off the fingerprints. But that painful procedure can wait. For now, it is enough that the brazen bank robber looks markedly different. Despite the DOI manhunt and the fact that Melvin Purvis and agents of the Chicago office are literally just a few miles away, Dillinger is filled with the false sense of confidence that he can walk the streets unrecognized. He also has a new birth certificate and falsified identification cards. But John Dillinger is mistaken about being secure. On the bank robber's 31st birthday, June 22, 1934, J. Edgar Hoover announces that a new category of criminal is now being hunted. This label applies to just one individual at a time. The term is Public Enemy Number One. And until he is either dead or incarcerated, that label now belongs solely to John Dillinger. Chapter 4. July 22, 1934, Chicago, Illinois, 8 p.m. Public Enemy Number One is feeling the heat. Chicago is enduring its hottest summer on record. The thermometer will spike to 109 degrees Fahrenheit tomorrow, an all-time high. At 101 degrees Fahrenheit, today is slightly cooler but no less daunting. Since the sun rose this morning, 23 Chicagoans have died from the extreme temperatures. Like many city residents, John Dillinger is spending this Sunday evening in a refrigerated movie house. He chooses the air-conditioned Biograph Theater on Lincoln Avenue, where William Powell, Myrna Loy, and Clark Gable are starring in Manhattan Melodrama. The Biograph is right around the corner from his rented hideout apartment at 2420 Halsted Street. For company, the bank robber brings along a redhead named Polly Hamilton, a lookalike of his recently incarcerated girlfriend Billy Frechette. Hamilton works as a waitress at the S&S sandwich shop, but in her younger years, as a teenage runaway from North Dakota, she worked as a prostitute for a Romanian madam named Anna Akalieva. Hamilton eventually made a new life, but remained friends with Anna, who is also Dillinger's landlady. The robber has invited both women to the movie tonight, not at all worried that Anna's lover is an East Chicago detective. Foolishly, Dillinger is trusting his landlady. Though a man squiring two women might draw attention, the wanted criminal is also unconcerned about that. A night on the town is nothing new since his plastic surgery, despite the federal manhunt. Dillinger is flush with cash, thanks to yet another bank robbery 3 weeks ago in South Bend, Indiana. Working with the equally notorious Pretty Boy Floyd and Babyface Nelson, the gang robbed the Merchants National Bank of almost $30,000, shooting a policeman dead in the process. Footnote. That sum would be worth $561,000 in modern dollars. End footnote. After dividing the money and escaping to Chicago, Dillinger moved out of Jimmy Probasco's cottage on the edge of town and rented an apartment on the city's north side to be closer to the action. Since then, John Dillinger has attended several Chicago Cubs games at Wrigley Field, visited the 1933-34 World's Fair, and enjoyed lunches at the Seminary restaurant. The bank robber makes sure to drink moderately and not be flashy with money, although he always insists on picking up the check. Through it all, John Dillinger is quietly planning one more big heist. However, instead of a bank, he will knock off a mail train. Mail trains are known to carry a fortune in cash. Then, Dillinger plans to turn away from his life of crime and escape to Mexico. Now, dressed in gray slacks, white shirt, and red tie, the bank robber purchases 3 tickets at the Biograph box office. Clark Gable's part is that of a ruthless gangster named Blackie Gallagher, a character said to be based on Dillinger himself. An intrigued John Dillinger steps into the theater. He has plans to make a movie of his own one day and is eager to witness his depiction on the screen. Dillinger quickly rushes Polly Hamilton and Anna Akleyeva through the crowded lobby to take their seats. As the cool of the theater takes the edge off the heat for John Dillinger, 20 federal agents are surrounding the Biograph Theater. Each exit is secured. For the next 2 long hours on this brutally hot night, the agents await the final act of Manhattan melodrama in which Blackie Gallagher is executed, hoping all the while to do the same to John Dillinger. Federal agent Melvin Purvis can't wait for the movie to end. Nervous Purvis, as his fellow DOI agents call him behind his back, stands outside the Biograph in front of the ticket booth. The special agent in charge, SAC, of the Division of Investigations Chicago Bureau carries a cigar and box of matches in his suit pocket. Purvis will light the cigar once he spots Public Enemy Number 1 leaving the theater. This will be the signal for his agents to move in and arrest John Dillinger. Purvis nervously scans the sidewalk in front of the theater. He can see the lighted cigarettes of his agents as they pass time in nearby alleys, sidewalks, and paired up at the exits of the Biograph. Since the fiasco at Little Bohemia, the search for John Dillinger has been a series of blunders. Stakeouts and surveillance of Dillinger's known accomplices have yielded no results. Even worse are the number of eyewitnesses who falsely claim to have witnessed the bank robber as far away as London. The transatlantic steamship Duchess of York was recently searched 3 times in one day because of rumors that Dillinger might be on board. As a result of his failure to capture Dillinger, Purvis's relationship with his boss has gotten increasingly worse. The agent has not been completely relieved of his duties as head of the Chicago Bureau, but J. Edgar Hoover has sent another agent, Samuel Cowley, from Washington, to lead the 40-man Dillinger squad. The 34-year-old Cowley is a terse bureaucrat with a pencil-thin mustache, pasty skin, and a gift for organization. The teetotaling Idaho native is the polar opposite of the hard-drinking southern-born Purvis. Yet while the two men are vastly different, they unite in their desire to capture John Dillinger. Earlier in the evening, when the location of the cinema where Dillinger planned to see a movie was unclear, Cowley and several agents staked out the downtown Marlboro Theater, 7 miles away. But once Dillinger was pinpointed, Cowley's team joined Purvis's at the Biograph. Both men are well aware that should tonight result in the successful capture or killing of John Dillinger, they are by no means allowed to take personal credit. That belongs solely to J. Edgar Hoover. The cardinal sin of a DOI career is deflecting the spotlight away from the director. One of the agents, Charlie Winstead, standing guard around the Biograph, will note of his time in the Washington Bureau, "Everyone at headquarters knows Hoover is an egomaniac, and they flatter him constantly." The truth is that Hoover is pondering a run for the presidency in 1936, but is careful to keep these thoughts private. He continues to seek the approval of current President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, knowing that FDR's new crime bills give the DOI and Hoover more power and publicity. The director sees no need to threaten that relationship. In addition to placing Agent Cowley in charge of the Dillinger investigation, Hoover has also gone to the extraordinary measure of adding a posse of sharpshooters to the Dillinger squad. The shootout at Little Bohemia proved that lawyers and accountants, occupations comprising the majority of DOI agents, are not up to the task of shooting it out with hardened criminals. Thus, a small band of detectives and police from Texas and Oklahoma have been recruited solely for their prowess with firearms, as well as having no problem with the moral ambiguity of shooting first and asking questions later. The posse trained for a month in Washington before traveling to Chicago. In stark contrast to the typical buttoned-down DOI agents, Hoover's hired guns, as they are known, prefer to wear Stetson hats, cowboy boots, and diamond pinky rings. They are also allowed to choose their own weapons. Two of these sharpshooters now stand just south of the Biograph's main entrance. Charles Hurt was formerly Oklahoma City's chief of detectives. Charles Winstead, known to be notoriously insubordinate within the division, spent the early part of 1934 chasing Bonnie and Clyde through Texas before being reassigned by Hoover. Though the owner of several handguns, Winstead has chosen a standard DOI issue 45 caliber automatic pistol this evening. Just prior to tonight's movie, Winstead and Hurt easily could have arrested John Dillinger, for he was just inches away as he walked past them into the theater. But the agents did not recognize the face-altered Dillinger, who lived to see one final film. The clock ticks slowly on this muggy evening. Manhattan Melodrama is 94 minutes long. Finally, at 10:20, the movie ends. Agent Purvis was made aware of Dillinger's presence at the film by none other than the bank robber's landlady, Anna Akalieva. The former madam is facing deportation charges as an alien of low moral character. In an effort to remain in the United States, she contacted Purvis through her boyfriend, East Chicago, Indiana policeman Martin Zarkovich, stating she could hand over John Dillinger. Purvis quickly made a deal with Anna that led him and his agents to the theater. Footnote: Anna was deported anyway. Though she received a $5,000 reward for her part in Dillinger's demise, J. Edgar Hoover ignored the deal she made with Purvis and supervised her return to Romania. Some believe the Dillinger killing was staged, using an innocent stranger instead of the bank robber, and that Anna's deportation was an attempt to keep her silent about her role in the cover-up. In June 2019, descendants of Dillinger filed a request to exhume his body to ascertain the truth about the corpse's identity. An Indiana judge refused to sign the permit. The authors of this book do not believe the conspiracy theory. End footnote. Earlier this evening, as Dillinger played pinochle with Polly Hamilton in Anna's apartment, the madam slipped out under the pretense of needing more butter to cook the fried chicken dinner she had planned for the three of them. Anna then called Purvis from a payphone. Once the call came in a few minutes past seven, the federal agents quickly took their places around the theater. Per J. Edgar Hoover's directive, the Chicago police were not informed of the operation. Now, as patrons begin exiting the theater, Anna, wearing a bright orange skirt, walks next to Dillinger and Hamilton. This is the signal that the man at her side is Dillinger. Purvis had instructed Anna to wear red. Indeed, she will go down in history as the Lady in Red. But orange is the closest color she has. Purvis strikes a match. The agent's hands are shaking, but he manages to light the cigar. Dillinger walks south on Lincoln Avenue, once again right past agents Winstead and Hurt. Both men have seen Purvis's signal and now fall in behind Dillinger. Hamilton hangs on the robber's left arm. Anna is to the left of Hamilton. A third DOI agent, young Herman Ed Hollis, falls in alongside Winstead and Hurt. Sensing danger, Dillinger suddenly wheels and sees the three men in suits. Suspecting they are agents, the bank robber shakes loose of Hamilton and Anna. He lunges toward a nearby alley. Simultaneously, Dillinger reaches in his pocket for a gun and lowers his body into a crouch. He whirled around and reached for his right front pocket, Winstead will remember in the official DOI version of events. Purvis will claim that he cried out for Dillinger to halt. Then, all three agents open fire. To this day, there is considerable debate about which agent's bullets actually killed John Dillinger. The majority opinion believes it to be Charles Winstead, the Texan known for insubordination. Regardless, public enemy number one is now dead. Six shots were fired, none by Dillinger. Two miss completely. Two others nick the bank robber but otherwise do no harm. Another penetrates the left side of his body. But the sixth shot shatters the vertebra in Dillinger's neck, destroying his spinal cord, passing through his brain, and exiting just beneath the right eye. Dillinger slams into the ground face first, landing just shy of the alley entrance. His last words are gibberish as the agents descend. A crowd forms around the dead man. Hearing it is Dillinger, citizens dip their handkerchiefs into his pool of blood as a keepsake. DOI agents push them back, but the throng presses forward once again, everyone straining for a look. As one, men and women begin saying the same word over and over. Dillinger. J. Edgar Hoover.